You are now listening to The Limitless, the podcast between. This is Jason Horsley talking to The Scrouse.
Have you heard that when you're doing a phone interview, you should always dress as if it's a real interview?
I might have heard something like that.
I've never conducted an interview, so I don't know if it's true that they can tell the difference.
Well, it would be, if you could tell the difference, wouldn't it? It's about getting in the right state of mind.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why my brother, that's what was partly behind my brother's dandyism, was that if he dressed up to the nines before he went out, he would have to get in a good mood once he was out there, because you can't slink around shamefaced when you're wearing a top hat and a velvet suit.
No, that's true, you can't. They're too hilarious and awesome.
It's a terrible pressure to put on oneself, though. I mean, I used to do the same, actually. I was my own kind of dandy. As
you could probably with your Indiana Jones phase, you mean? Or
prior to that, I mean, that was closer to the kind of dressing down that I eventually ended up with, trying to blend in. But before that, I was dressing like a shaman. I would dress in campesino clothes, like all white linen. Carry around a magic wand. I would have bizarre symbols hanging from my ears and wrists and stuff. So I very much look very obviously like somebody who thought they were a sorcerer.
You mean like a poser?
Yeah.
You really were, though. You were the real deal. Hey, I see the recording button is lit.
Yeah, and I gave you the option to record too, so that we're covered this time. We don't want to risk,
right. I don't mind that we didn't get the last one recorded. I felt like it was I was a little off. I don't want your viewers to be let down, but they're not here to listen to me. Regardless of your guests, they're here to listen to you.
Well, you say that. You don't know that.
Oh, speaking of which, I heard your last Saturday's show, the Mixler show, and I really appreciated your honesty about how frustrated and angry you were about, you know, beating your head against the wall all these years and getting 12 viewers out of it. I feel the same way. It's painful.
Mm. Yeah, I think a lot of people do. And I think there's a general, I don't know if it's an agreement, but there's a general attitude not to talk about it because it's embarrassing or inappropriate or something, and self-indulgent perhaps. But there was a lot of pressure, so I felt I needed to.
To let off the steam?
Yeah, respond to it at least.
Well, there's not enough people. It was nice and honest. And if we're all feeling that way, why can't we talk about it? There's all this pressure to be positive. And how can anybody be that positive where everything's going right all the time, you know?
Well, that was one of the things I was discussing, wasn't it, as well, was the false hope and the pressure to create and go along with hope narratives or hope-driven narratives, and how my refusal to do that has no doubt been one of the factors that's prevented me from reaching more people.
I wonder why.
Because I don't offer hope. False hope.
Right, the false hope. Which isn't really worth the paper it's printed on.
Counterfeit.
Yeah. I mean,
if you can spend the counterfeit, people don't care, I suppose.
That's true. I spend Canadian pennies all the time.
Oh, yeah? With who? Yeah. Wow.
I don't know. Whoever will take them. Everybody takes them. They don't look twice.
Wait, you still use pennies in the US?
Yeah.
Oh,
do you,
okay.
do you have you gotten rid of your pennies?
Well, that's why you've got all those Canadian pennies.
Yeah. I see.
Yeah, we get a lot of U.S. dimes and nickels and quarters.
Oh, sure, yeah. We get some of those from Canada as well.
Yeah.
How did you decide to start a thrift store?
I didn't decide. I mean, I went along with it. We went along with it, but it fell into our hands.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah. Interesting. So you inherited it somehow.
Well, no, we did buy it. We bought it as a business, but we were just in the right place at the right time, and somebody offered it to us very cheaply, and we thought, sure, let's try it. We'd been trying for several months to set up a local radio station, and had bought the transmitter and had installed it on our roof and everything, and it didn't work. It only transmitted like a block.
What?
And all this was geared towards somehow bringing the community together, like a project that would help people become more aware of being part of a community. So when that failed, the thrift store just filled the space that, you know, we'd created. This is my belief anyway. And provided the thing that we were looking for, which was, and then some, because I don't know how much we were considering the radio would be a source of income. I suppose we were thinking in the long run with advertising, or I can't remember now, but I'm sure we were thinking, you know, like hopefully we can actually make this into a business. But that was an even longer shot than just getting the radio station on the road.
Right.
So the main focus was the community, and then the thrift store came along. And so I think there's a blueprint in that they have that saying, you know, God, nothing makes God laugher than man making plans.
Yeah.
But I think that that's unfair and just cynical about God. Because I think that if we make plans for something and they're more or less our hearts in the right place, God may pull the rug out. He may laugh a little bit and pull the rug out under, but he also acknowledges that we've made the right show of willing, and then he says, not that, but this.
Okay. And so it's, you say, even more so as far as being a community hub or gathering place.
Yeah, and now I'm thinking about doing a radio, because now I'm doing the Mixlr thing. I'm like, oh, well, that's quite easy to do internet radio. So I'm kind of lazily and slowly recruiting people. If they want to participate in the community radio locally, then we can, you know, maybe that plan will bear fruit after all.
That's interesting. That's how my podcast started. There's a local low power radio station that just takes volunteers to be on air.
All right.
It's pretty great. Well, they use the term volunteer loosely. You actually have to pay $10 for every show that you produce, you know, but.
All right. Well, I suppose I could swing it that way, but it's only $10 a month to have a Mixlr channel 3 hours a day. So
really?
As long as that's covered, then.
Wow. So you have all this time available to you to be on air or on.
I do
online.
Currently, yeah. I have whatever that would be, 20 hours a week that I'm not using.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I could use it, of course. I mean, I could just put music on or something, and that might be a way to get people in the habit of listening. That would probably be the smart play, although it would be difficult because I want to use my computer.
That's true. You'd have to have a dedicated computer doing it.
Yeah.
With all the files and everything, too.
No, it's not. It's not. That's not a problem. It's very simple. You just hook up the software to your, or you just put your music stuff. You link your music files to the software, and it feeds into your hard drive, basically, in that way. Or
oh, okay,
takes
I see.
The music from your hard drive, but you don't have to reload it or anything like that.
Oh, that's handy.
Yeah.
So the Are there liminalists in your town that you would put on 20 hours a week?
Well, it wouldn't be 20 hours a week. It would be just 1 hour a week or whatever. They could go up to 3 hours a week, but one day a week they could have a slot.
Sure.
I don't know how liminal they are. I'm really just looking for willing. Well, not just willing, of course, have to be. But it wouldn't have to be. It wouldn't have to be liminalists. They just have to be locals.
Oh, okay. So it would be to actually create a community, like a real community in this world where everything is overseas, over the internet, over the wires.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much this has been done. I mean, obviously on Facebook, they have groups that relate to towns. We have one. So that's a virtual community that represents a physical community. So presumably there are, well, you said yourself that you're part of a radio thing that's the same. Right? But is the focus of that radio station, is it on the community or is it just happen to be people in the same place?
I don't know how community focused they are, but they want to give a voice to anybody who has something to say. So,
right. So that was my, because we did a newsletter for about a year and then I passed it on to the local secondhand book guy, but he didn't continue. It was called The Seedling, and that was the criteria there. To write for it, you either had to live in Hope or you had to write about Hope, or both.
Wait, Hope is the name of your town?
Yeah, you didn't get that yet?
No, I didn't.
So what did you think when I said coming to you live from Hope?
I don't know. I guess I didn't pay any attention. Hmm. That's a great name for a town.
Well, it's ironic. In my case.
Is it?
The anti-hoper from Hope.
Oh, right. But you're the anti-false hoper, which might mean you're the actual hoper.
I have hope that we can somehow let go of false hope.
Yeah.
And what would that mean? It's probably a good topic. I feel as though we haven't exactly started yet. I mean, we have because we're recording, but in terms of actually, you know, starting to move into a meaty conversation, like we're doing our version of small talk.
Yeah, are we?
Which is fine.
Oh, I see.
We don't often do that. I don't often do that.
So if you get rid of false hope, does it automatically get filled with real hope? Or is there something else that can fill in the absence? More despair, I suppose?
I think you got to have I think despair is probably just absence of hope. So if you get rid of the false hope, you're going to experience despair initially, aren't you? Because it's not as though the true hope would just instantly whoosh into that vacuum, particularly if it's so poorly distributed that we're not surrounded by true hope that we just haven't noticed because we're focusing on false hope. It's more like with a counterfeit. If the economy gets flooded with counterfeit, eventually there's more counterfeit notes than real. So as I say, people just spend the counterfeit. Nobody knows the difference. And then they don't even have anything to compare it to because there's less and less real currency out there. So I think it's probably something like that. So then, if you just start letting go of false hope, you can't guarantee that it'll just get replaced by real hope.
So you can't just cut it down. It has to be, you can't just demolish it. You have to take it apart carefully and replace it with real hope then.
Right. Demolishing, that would be nihilism, wouldn't it? We just say there is no hope, everything's fine.
Right. I mean, I suppose.
Anyone can say that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I say it myself sometimes, but I try to only say it when I'm feeling optimistic, and that's an expression of optimism. Everything's fucked. We're all fucked. It's great. There's a real opportunity in that.
Okay. So maybe demolishing it would be good then, because then we'd realize we have our opportunity.
No, I think you're right. You're right the first time. I think if it gets demolished too quickly, then we just wouldn't recover. It'd be too painful. I mean, it's like in therapy or any relationship. If you see someone's delusion, you don't just you know, clobber them with what you see. By the way, you're completely deluded. And I know you put all your life energy for 20 years in this dream, but it's never going to happen. You can't do that if you want to stay friends with them.
Right. Yeah. I would leave a friend who said that to me.
Sure. Especially if he was right.
Huh? Yeah, exactly. Because that's when it hurts the most.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how can we start taking this apart then? Is there any kind of strategy that you've thought of or considered?
I have, but I think it's only because of doing it so often that I start to notice. So I've done this before, so maybe there's a method in this that I'm unconscious of. It's kind of like with the thrift store, as in once the thrift store came up, and that maybe that's an example, because we had a hope about the radio station. It was a false hope. It got dashed by reality, and now we're just sitting there, oh, I failed again. And then the thrift store comes, you know, sidling into that vacuum.
Right. But okay, so was the radio station a false hope or was it just a hope that didn't pan out?
What's the difference?
A false hope might be something that could never pan out, but you had actually taken steps. You had the transmitter, you had everything set up.
It failed though.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what's the difference if it could have panned out in a different universe? It didn't in this one. So.
Okay.
So it was a false hope.
But you weren't deluded, right? I mean, it wasn't like you were.
Well, we were wrong. And I certainly did. I did know the whole time. In retrospect, I said I did know it wasn't going to work, because the whole time I was thinking, this is not going to work. This is not going to work. It's too ambitious.
Oh.
I just felt that. Like, this is so ambitious to try and create a radio station the old way with technology, you know, old technology. And
right.
I just thought there's going to be, but let's try it anyway. I think it was my wife's idea. And she is a lot more optimistic in the conventional sense than I am. You could say in our relationship, it's almost a cliche or a trope. You know, you have these movies and TV shows in which there's two characters and one is always sunny and bright and saying it's all going to work out and the other's grumbling. And like Tigger and Eeyore, you know?
Right, right.
So it was probably her idea, and she was probably kept saying, yeah, it's going to work. And I'm like, no, it's not.
Wow. Does she ever get sick of that? I imagine it must get difficult at times.
Why just for her? I don't think it's difficult for me.
Oh, sure. But okay, so, and as an example of false hope being dashed, it all fell apart. It all came crumbling down all at once. It wasn't slowly dismantled.
Well, it was, because it took a while to figure out it wasn't going to work. So there was hope, and then there was a bit less hope, and then there was a bit less hope.
Okay. So you personally weren't devastated by the loss of this hope.
No.
But the thrift store didn't come in to take its place until all the hope was gone.
That's right. And it wasn't as though, oh shit, we can't do the radio station, let's open a thrift store either. It was just, oh shit, we can't do a radio station. What are we going to do now? So then there was a period, I don't remember how long it was. It was at least weeks. Well, I say that, but actually I think it was really close together. I'm thinking because my sister and niece were here when I put the radio thing on the roof. We've got a picture of it. It's a very good picture, because I look like a superhero, you know, standing with a staff of power on the pinnacle of a cathedral or something like that. So it
was
looks
it
like
in the background?
Well, no, but you could Photoshop it in and it would fit. And it looks like a victorious kind of image.
Cool.
But they were there, and they were also here when we took the thrift store. So I'm thinking that maybe it really was that close together. But even so, it wasn't like we went looking for it because of that, because we didn't go looking for it at all. The actual cause or factor wasn't anything to do with the radio station. The apparent cause or factor was that somebody had given us a car because they'd met my wife when she was working in the bookshop, the secondhand bookshop, and they liked her. And they had a car they didn't want to use anymore, and they just wanted, didn't want to sell it, just wanted to give it to somebody they liked. So he gave us his car. We didn't really want a car, but we just thought, why not? You never know, we might use it sometimes. It's free. Then we decided, well, it's a free car, we should share it too.
Wow.
Make a carpool or whatever, you know, a communal car. So then we went in the thrift store to say, do you want to help us with this? Spread the word about the car, and we can have a book here, and people can come in here if they want to use the car, right? This is, this will be the nub for the community car.
Wow.
And because of that, we were trying to work that out, which never happened. When that person decided to sell the thrift store, which is only a few days later, we were the first to know.
That's fascinating. So there were two things that got smashed, not just the radio station, but the community car.
It didn't get smashed, though. That just got forgotten because we had bigger fish to fry.
Oh, sure. Okay. I see. So that got put aside.
But that was also part of the show of willing. We were the community radio. We were showing we wanted to be part of the community. The car thing, we were showing we wanted to give something to the community. And then the thrift store was like, oh, we could make money this way. Yes, let's do it. So we weren't even thinking, oh, the thrift store would be a way to help the community. Not at all. We were thinking, oh, the thrift store would be a way to pay the bill. We better take this opportunity. So that's wow. Another element, I think, is that, you know, I'm always criticizing this whole thing about making the world a better place because I think it's egomaniacal. I think it's a mistake. I also think it's not totally naive and probably deluded because I don't think the world... I don't think the world even exists as a whole thing, but if it did, there's no way that we could change it. I would say that. Not after millennia of building it. We're not just going to say, oh, we don't like the way the world is, and now we've wised up. We can just, you know, start. Yeah. We can just dismantle it or tweak it. It's all about tweaking, isn't it? But anyway, that was a sidetrack. But if we went about just to make money, But all the ways in which we'd been given the opportunity to make money were very organic and a result of our being part of the community and trying to give something to community. And somehow the will to just make money for ourselves corresponded with or became congruent with something that was for everybody. Right?
So with the thrift store.
That's what I'm talking about. The thrift store itself was our way of making money, but... because we were in tune with the community by that point, the local community, it has provided us with something that would help us and it. So that's like a natural system that's working together.
Did you know the thrift store would be a community project?
No.
So that surprised you?
Yeah, we didn't know it would be successful, but we thought it probably will because it's a pretty safe bet. It didn't occur to us, I don't believe, that this would be a way to benefit the community. I mean, certainly we would have thought this is what's the phrase I'm looking for? Not guilt-free, because guilt is just pretty stupid anyway. But I mean, it's a purely ethical kind of capitalism, because we won't be
sure.
You know, buying new stuff or reselling, you know, whatever. It'll just be a redistribution of wealth. I think we were aware of that early on. This will just be a way to recycle used goods and make a little money for doing it. So there won't be any ethical concerns.
Sure.
Right. We were aware of that, but I don't think we took it further to thinking, oh, actually, we'll be doing, it's an opportunity to do good. Because, I mean, that's not my nature anyway. I don't look for opportunities to do good. Not really.
Really? The radio? And what was the radio station? That wasn't...
Well, okay, so that's a good point. But that was a combination of things. My idea for the radio station was this, that we could recreate what something that was in ancient Greece, which was they'd have a town square where people would meet and they would discuss problems, but there'd be community problems, but there'd also be philosophical problems. So the community problems would be an opportunity for people to work, to get together and work things out, but also to understand better themselves. And so there's this intersection, like we're touching on now, between material problems and philosophical problems. Like if we deal with material problems, we will understand things better philosophically. So that was the idea of the radio station. Like, people are scrapping and bickering on Facebook. Let's take it up a few notches and have it actually a communal radio where people, where you have discourse, like in the olden times, and you have somebody there, which would have been me, maybe other people, who has some philosophical background and knows how to keep recalibrating. So one of the maxims was going to be, what was it? Feelings aren't opinions. Opinions aren't facts. Facts aren't truth. So to always be aware, is this feeling now or is it opinion? Is it opinion or is it fact? Is it fact or is it truth? And keep passing that, you know, when people are wrestling with problems. So that was one of the ideas, you know, like to create a context for resolving problems that was, that had a philosophical tradition behind it, let's say. So yeah, that was like, this would be good for the community, but it was also like for me as a communicator, that would be fun, right? So that was the primary thing. This will be fun.
That's a great idea. And I love how something that's beneficial to somebody else can also be fun for the person who's starting it. And do you see that your Mixlr work will follow into that?
It might. I'm not sure about the Mixlr right now. I'm not sure where it's going. So that's, I mean, I guess that's, somebody said to me in an email today, I feel like I'm doing all the talking, so I have to watch out for that. But because people will complain, they will. They'll say, I wanted to hear this guy, and you're doing all the talking. And I'll say, that's, well, he said,
I'm an unknown. He said,
my listeners just want to hear me talk. So
that's what I thought.
Anyway,
the great thing about Mixlr as opposed to a radio station is that you can take your laptop anywhere in hope and set up shop and start talking to somebody.
In theory, you could. I wouldn't do that personally. I don't actually use Wi-Fi on my laptop for one thing.
Oh, really? But it, okay.
Yeah.
So you were connected by a wire, by a wire on Saturday?
Old fashioned, yeah.
Wow, that's pretty old, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I see.
But let's go back to the fun thing. Having fun.
That helps.
That helps people.
But not without the pretense of making the world a better place.
Yeah, without that, that's right. Because it's not fun to try and make the world a better place. How could that be fun? Like, that's too, you know? Seriously. Hey, let's take on the CIA and dismantle millennia of power abuse. That'll be fun.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of work, too. It's like fighting the Hydra. I mean, you can't do it.
Yeah. Well, no, I would agree. You can't do it. But certainly, if you were going to embark on it, you wouldn't want to embark on it in the spirit of, hey, this will be fun.
Yeah. Probably not.
We can get along.
But on the other hand, I would question, could we help other people without having fun doing it? Would it be helpful?
Sometimes it is. There's, you know, you hear about the old country, stories from the old country. My grandma, when she was a child, her mother, they were working in the field, and her mother went insane right there in the field. And so my grandmother took over as matriarch.
How do you mean she went insane?
She had some kind of breakdown. I don't know how it was diagnosed, but she started stripping.
She started stripping in the field?
Yeah, and so my grandma had to take her home and pick up the clothes. And
was this before you were born?
Yeah.
So this was a story that you heard about growing up?
It is, yeah. And that, it didn't recur. I just heard it one time.
Who did you hear it from?
I think my mom told it to me.
So did it become a funny story then?
No, it was a tragic story. It was a story about how hard it was in the old country and how hard my grandma had it, or how hard her childhood was. Because she had to take over working in the fields, to all the household work, raising her sisters and brothers.
Right. But did your mother feel close to her mother?
I believe so.
Well, I haven't raised a family, so I can't say, but I presume that that's got to be fun too, otherwise it would start to show, wouldn't it? If people are trying to help you or serve you or look after you and they resent you for it.
Oh, sure. But I mean, there's, like in this example, it was a very difficult thing, but I'm sure she didn't resent her mother, except maybe in those dark hours, you know. When
she went mad.
When my great-grandmother went mad, when my grandmother, you know, was maybe just overwhelmed, would feel bad, sorry for herself, moments of self-pity.
I thought it was your mother who lost it and stripped.
No, my great-grandmother lost it, and my grandmother took over.
Several generations back. So, yeah. But your mother was there when grandmother...
No, she wasn't born yet. So she heard the story from somebody.
That story really had legs, huh?
Yeah. Well, there was no TV.
And because it had a moral to it. Like in our day, if you knew how hard it was.
Exactly. And the thing was, is that they did know how hard it was, right? My grandmother was running from the Russians, pregnant with my mother at the end of World War II. And then there was all that hardship, you know, of the bombed out Europe growing up in that. There's mm-hmm. horror, you know, not horror stories, but there's my uncles telling us stories about how they had to give away their toys for a loaf of stale bread. Real story. Sounds like a cliche.
Do you think if you had kids, I'm assuming you don't, you would tell them how hard it was when you were a kid compared to now?
I don't think I would. Because it would be so unbelievable. The only hardships I suffered were, you know, having, you know, not my dad not around or stuff like that, getting picked on in middle school. And it doesn't really compare
to
being so hungry you give away all your possessions for a loaf of bread.
Well, but how would it compare to a child, if you were raising a child in today's world? Because on the one hand, they might be complaining that you don't let them use their cell phone 24 hours a day. And you'd say, well, I was a kid, I couldn't even watch TV except for 1 hour a week.
Yeah, I would probably do that. But I don't know that that's a comparison of suffering.
No, I don't.
It's a comparison of inconvenience.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So at what point does inconvenience become suffering?
Oh, when it becomes things like hunger or, you know, actually it might be, I was going to say when it becomes physical, you know, starvation or abuse, but there's also severe emotional abuse that is suffering.
But yeah, there is. But see, there's another side to this question. It just occurred to me, is at what point does convenience become suffering?
So at what point would I suffer because of an abundance of convenience?
Yeah. Don't you think we are?
I certainly think we are. I know I am. It's the invisible suffering. Yeah. You know, you think everything's so great, but yet you're too weak to break out of the shell, you know, like the chicken.
What's the shell?
You ever hear the story that, of, I don't know where I heard this. There was a guy, there was a chicken, they have to peck their way out of the shell. Yeah. And he's like, oh, I'm going to help the chicken. So he breaks the shell open and the chicken dies because it's too weak to live. Because it didn't have to struggle against the shell.
Is that a true story, do you think?
It's a true illustration. I don't know if it's, you know, historical or fact-based. But
it's a great story, though. I mean, it's a great anecdote. Back to the trying to make the world a better place or trying to help people when it's not fun. And by fun here, we could you know, recalibrate it, make it a bit deeper, as in when it's not, when it doesn't feel like a genuinely meaningful or satisfying thing for us to do.
Uh-huh.
And we do it for other reasons, because we think we should, or because, and so on, you know, rather than it just being
a lighthearted romp.
Just a natural impulse to help. So that guy, if he'd been the guy who broke the chicken out of the egg because he felt sorry for it,
mm-hmm.
he wasn't, you know, acting instinctively, it's clear. He would have been overriding his instincts.
Which would have been just let the chicken do its own thing. It knows what it's doing.
Yeah. I mean, I presume his instincts just wouldn't have had anything to say or do at that point. It was just, it's a chicken in an egg. It's, you know, right? But some other part of him that was sentimental, like saw that, couldn't deal with it, over-identified with the chick, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God, no. I've got to save it. Was trying to save himself by.
Yeah, I could see that scenario. Sure. So, what are you getting at?
Oh, just I suppose the general theme. I think it probably relates to false hope as well, but the general theme of trying to help people if it's not fun. And trying to make the world a better place and imposing our own ideas about, but the larger, well, it's not larger, but the specific subject I was curious about getting into was what makes the world a better place anyway?
Well,
and you know, I don't mean who, but in terms of what are the criteria for a better world? Is it a world that's more convenient? Is the most convenient world also the best world? Apparently not. Like we've definitely crossed the line, haven't we, now, where suffering in the old-fashioned way that you're describing has been so removed from our experience. We've been so cushioned by technology that we're now suffering in all kinds of new ways that our ancestors never had to experience.
Right, right. And they're unprecedented. We don't have any way to even understand what's going on.
Some of them we don't even have words for.
Right. Right, wow.
So what's your view about that?
I can't even hardly grasp it. It's just, it's too big. It's too big to take hold of. But if I look at something like the abortion controversy, which I was dead set against for most of my life until I started to realize maybe this is, you know, just the way the universe is operating population control now that, you know, we're artificially living longer and more fruitful because of vaccines and more food and less war. I don't know if that's true, but seems like it's possible. So I don't remember what my point was.
Well, it's about abortion. So yeah, so
I don't remember. I don't know how I connected that to the subject.
Well, it's obviously a thorny subject. So you're saying that in the past you were against abortion, but then you began to wonder over the years, well, maybe it's just inevitable and necessary because we're overpopulating.
Yeah, something along those lines. And that,
because that's an example of convenience, isn't it? It's very convenient for women to have abortions, and it's become easier and easier to do so in every way, technologically, financially, morally, you name it.
Right, right. You know, well, that's a different subject. So, yeah, darn, I can't remember at all why I brought it up. It's some kind of example of convenience. And well, suffering.
I think creating
suffering.
Certainly a formative one, because we're talking about birth or the lack of it. And even if we bring it to cesarean births as well, like they're becoming more and more common because, again, they're convenient. It's more convenient for a woman to have a cesarean birth than to have a natural birth.
Yeah, for everybody. Doctors, everybody.
Everybody except the child.
Right.
My niece has a scar on her face because
what?
Her mother had to have a cesarean because of complications. She didn't just choose to. And they, when they cut her open, they cut my niece's face. So that would be like Psycho, a formative experience of out of Hitchcock's Psycho. You know?
Yeah. I hope she turned out all right.
Yeah, she's turned out very well.
Good.
Against all the odds.
Yeah, that's like the first thing you see in the world is a traumatic experience. That's rough. Well,
that's probably universal, I'd say, but there are degrees of
trauma. For sure.
But I think the cesarean thing is probably closer to the chick analogy, that a child that's born through cesarean birth would be like the chick.
Yeah.
Isn't allowed to struggle to break the shell.
Right, where the broken shell was done by the guy through some kind of compassion, maybe false compassion, and the cesarean is done for just convenience for everybody. Well, except in this case, it was...
Oh, it's financial profit. Necessary. Yeah, well, that, and sometimes it's for necessary, but as a general thing, I imagine financial profit is the main incentive.
Right, right.
Well, one of the things that I'm always coming back to, and this is, you know, a big subject, is why do I feel so strongly that the world is worse than it's ever been and it's just getting worse?
I think we all feel that way. But is it true, though? I mean, the plague is coming back, maybe. But it's not here. It's not, you know, we don't have mass deaths through disease going on.
There are countless ways in which you could illustrate that things are better now than they've ever been. Like this is right. What I'm saying. I have this, and I resist all of them. And I've got a unified argument against them. But is it valid? But my unified argument against them, it's probably partly laziness because I can't argue everything case by case. And I wouldn't necessarily want to live 200 years ago if that meant I was being shoved up a chimney, you know,
when I
was 6 years old, or, you know, or forced to live in a house with 30 other relatives. Or, you know, there's examples from the extreme abuse to just the, you know, extremely uncomfortable and inconvenient.
Yeah.
But there's loads of them, right?
Yeah.
And the diseases and the early deaths and the lack of... I mean, medicine is the main argument, you know, against things being worse now than in the past. But there are countless others. But anyway, my unified argument is to do with this convenience, is that we may avoid more and more coarse kinds of physical suffering through the developments of medicine and technology and economy and living conditions and wealth and all the rest of it, luxury basically. We may reduce all kinds of physical brutal suffering, but we are introducing ourselves to new levels of suffering which are totally unfamiliar, totally new, and increasingly subtle and insidious, and I think encroaching, as you said, getting less and less physical and more spiritual, like it's like a spiritual kind of suffering that we're undergoing more and more now. And I think that that's inseparable from the way that convenience, luxury, wealth, all the rest of it disconnects us from the natural world. Because that, I think that that's our point of reference for the spirit, for spiritual reality. Like if we can't refer to the physical directly.
Wait, our reference to the spiritual is being connected to the physical?
Yeah. Yeah, like embedded in the natural world.
Right. We're totally separate from it.
Well, not totally, are we? Because if we were, we'd be dead, I suppose. But
right. All right.
There's these layers of artifice.
Yeah. But, you know, we're not, you know, walking on the farm and harvesting and butchering, carrying water.
I had to kill a rat the other day with my bare hands. Well, no, I used a brick, actually, but I had to start with my bare hands.
Wow.
Yeah. It ran under the couch while we were watching Deadwood.
That show has really great dialogue, I understand. A friend of mine loves it.
It's fantastic, yeah.
Kind of ironic choice to run under the couch and then have to kill it.
Yeah, so we caught it, and then I took it out in the yard, and then I clubbed it to death with a brick, and it was quite upsetting to do that.
Yeah, I'll bet.
And there was a period in which I had it in the blanket, and I was deciding, do I kill you or do I not? And in the end, I just thought, because these rats have been bugging us for quite some time. I don't know how many there are living in the house, or if they come and go. We don't know what the situation is. We just know that there are rats, and they make a lot of noise, and they leave a lot of shit and piss, and they get in the food. Yeah, yeah. This is not practical. We can't just happily cohabitate. So I just felt there's no way I can be sure he's not going to come right back in if I let him go. Even if I take him down a block or two, he might have found a setup that's too good for him, too convenient. He's just going to come right back. So I'm sorry, you're going to have to die now.
Yeah, and I think that's totally reasonable. We forget that we're predators, you know.
Yeah,
Every animal on earth understands the score except people.
Right. That's the false hope. Right? That we don't acknowledge the score.
Right. Right. And that exactly. Exactly. And we're running from it and hiding from it with all our technology and medicine and even religion to some extent, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's
eternal life and
yeah, the afterlife that's going to compensate for the sufferings in this life. And although it does seem as though that was more realistic, ironically, than our current kind of false hopes, doesn't it?
I think it was healthier.
I mean, I say more realistic because one of the elements of the religious faith was that this world is temporal, we're going to die, everything is just dust. So nothing we do here has any meaning or purpose unless it's in devotion or service or acknowledgement of the eternal. That is a more realistic attitude than if we live a good life and we have kids and we raise them well and we leave the world a slightly better place than we came in, then we've contributed to progress. Therefore, our life has meaning.
Right, right. Well, yeah, And it, if you don't have the myth of progress, that's a lot less to worry about.
Well, it leaves you with death to worry about, doesn't it? Or eternity. So it's, you could say it's more.
I suppose, yeah.
It's more and less, isn't it?
But if you get used to thinking about it or living with it, dealing with it.
Well, interesting thing.
Part of life, right? What? I mean, we used to understand it. We didn't. Yeah. Our old people were not shunted aside. And
well, I think there's probably an innate ability to deal with eternity in the body or something like that. Certainly death, when we could stop it just before the edge there with eternity. But death is eternity, well, however you slice it. On the other side of death is eternity, right? So, what was I saying? Yeah, to think, you can't deal with eternity. If you think about the world and progress and improving the world, that seems like, hey, I could actually do something about that. So then it becomes something huge, because to really have an impact on the world big enough to really change the direction of the world, you'd have to be Bill Gates or something. You'd have to become a sociopath driven by nothing but, you know, raw ambition to leave your mark on the world. Not
right.
Not a good
and
outcome.
What
and then what happens?
And then you have the Fabian Society.
Well, and then you have transhumanism. You've got to actually use all that money to try and build a, you know, a digital version of yourself and live forever. So eventually it comes to eternity anyway. But sure. If you stay with just death and eternity, there's nothing you can do about that unless you're, you know, Bill Gates, and you've already gone so far into delusion that you think you can cheat death. But if you haven't, you know, started on that path, and you just start with, or you stay with the physical awareness of death as a pending reality and eternity on the other side, and you just say, I'm going to put my faith in God, whatever, you know, that means. It doesn't have to be Orthodox religion, but, you know, I'm going to put my faith in something that is greater, that is eternal. Then there's nothing you can do. So you actually, it doesn't let you off the hook, but it does neutralize that part that was trying to drive you into, you know, running around insanely trying to fix everything before you die.
Right.
Because you're like, well, I can't fix that.
Yeah.
So I better just contemplate.
Contemplate? Like, you mean like we're doing now, or contemplate God?
Aren't we contemplating God now?
Yeah, I suppose, maybe. I don't know. I've seen more in the more abstract sense, you know.
But it is that's a conundrum, you know. How do you contemplate the infinite? You can't really, but
no.
I'd say we're having a somewhat contemplative conversation. And contemplation doesn't just mean sitting alone in silence. I say it has more to do with something subtler, which is being in the present and just observing what's happening in the present. I know I'm going to die. How do I feel about that? You know, even, you know, how's the body doing? And I mean, obviously one doesn't want to be a hypochondriac, but certainly an awareness of the body and an awareness of death are quite congruent without there necessarily being a fear factor there.
I don't know. The fear factor is pretty strong.
Yeah.
You know, even believing in the afterlife, there's always the nagging, how do you really know?
Yeah. So do you believe?
I used to believe 100% for sure, no doubt. But now I don't have any idea.
You don't have any?
It would be nice to have an afterlife.
It would be nice. Yeah, maybe, depend where you ended up.
Yeah, right. Or even how you ended up, right? Like in paradise, or just absorbed by a galactic consciousness and then dissolving. That wouldn't be that great either, I don't think.
Oh, well, it might not be easy to undergo the process, but at the end of it, you would be one with galactic consciousness, so I presume galactic consciousness would be all right about it.
Being one with God. I don't know, maybe.
Well, it's a big...
Isn't that just death then? Isn't that just the eternal nothing of death?
I mean, that's a, it's a thought stopper, because I guess it depends what we want to take with us, doesn't it? As in, I mean, my solution, so to speak, didn't like the my there. It was a bit of, I felt the ego in that my solution, people, fellow countrymen. Like personally, for me, the solution when I'm, you know, for the fear factor, let's say, is that whatever the afterlife is, depends on us experiencing it in the present. Like it's accessible to us now, and I don't mean by talk, by Ouija boards or channeling or mediums. I mean in a different way, like galactic consciousness. I used to talk about that a lot. I used to say, you know, we're moving into galactic consciousness. I don't anymore, but I think it might be true enough. But galactic consciousness anyway, we're already embedded in galactic consciousness, and it's already, the galaxy is already conscious.
Okay, sure, yeah. And we're part of it.
And we're part of it, and so it's conscious through us. So from the perspective, if we're part of it, then we're part of it now. So what we actually are, won't experience anything on death. There will be no change.
Ah, interesting. Just some kind of transition that we don't quite understand at the moment, only seeing it from one side.
Right. So it's a bit like the whole conundrum with the unconscious. Like we call it the unconscious. We say when we're asleep, we're unconscious, but we know we're not because we dream. But then we wake, we don't remember. So all we can do is call it unconscious. But from the point of view of the dream life, if we can remember, and sometimes this is true, our ordinary waking life when we're dreaming, then this is the unconscious, what we're in now, because it's relative.
Okay.
So you could say that we're relatively unconscious compared to when we're asleep, at least some of the time. And so then you could also say we're relatively unconscious now compared to when we're dead, which is an interesting proposition, isn't it?
It's very interesting. Hopefully it'll be some kind of transition like that.
Well, that's the crux, is the transition. How's the transition going to be? And the optimal condition is no transition at all. As in, we're already dead when we die. Not in the soul dead. Not as in walking zombies, because there's plenty of people who've attained that state. But in a sense, we're already as conscious as we will become when we die.
Oh, so basically you mean enlightened.
Yeah. basically that is a word that we have stuck on something that has never been defined, right?
Well, that's true too.
And so it's not basic, is it?
It's pretty advanced, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, but fully conscious.
I could float.
And so, perhaps when we were more connected to the physical world through absence of technology, we were more aware that life continued, or consciousness.
That's what I think. Have you ever read Norman Brown?
Norm Brown.
Norman O. Brown. Norm, no. For sure. Yeah, he wrote a book called Life Against Death, and in that he talks about how we can only face death if we're fully embodied. Like, when we're fully in our bodies and we fully have an experience of being physically here, then death is no longer an issue or an obstacle. So you could reduce that to a bit of a cliche, as, you know, in order to die, you've got to fully live. But you have to flip that around and say, in order to fully live, you've got to be fully aware that you're going to die. But I'd say both of those relate to, yeah, just being fully in the body, which I think relates to the body being fully conscious, for consciousness being in the body.
Okay, well, there's several things here that I'm lacking understanding of. Start with consciousness in the body.
Yeah.
I just read a book about octopuses, and it turns out that their brain has no distinct beginning or ending as physical boundary, and it projects all the way into their tentacles.
Wow.
But that's not what you're talking about. We're not talking about our thinking.
Well, I don't
suppose literally through our body.
Wait, let's slow down.
Oh.
Because you said a lot already. Octopuses don't think, first of all.
Well, that we know of. I mean,
we've got to define what thinking is, because when you think, what are the quanta of thought for you?
You mean like sub-vocalization, or are you talking about language?
Well, I don't know. I'm asking, but how would you describe a thought that you had? Would it be an image, a smell, a word, a bunch of words, or all of the above?
All of the above, sometimes together, sometimes
synesthetic thought. Right. Okay.
I wouldn't say synesthetic, but it, yeah. Okay. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
You're going to go with synesthetic. I would think.
I am, just because your thoughts are always different. It could
sounds
be
good.
An image. It could be a words, a sentence.
Okay. Well, so when I think of thinking, I think of language. So that's all I mean.
Okay.
Octopuses don't think in language. So we've got thinking, we've got thought, we've got awareness, we've got consciousness. Those are all possibly subtly or more than subtly different. So that's number one obstacle to understanding. Number two, the octopus, you're saying its brain, what? Its brain is in all of its body parts?
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not literally true. It has a physical brain.
Right, and its physical brain also extends into its tentacles.
How does it extend?
It's neurons.
So it doesn't. So how does it have a physical brain at all, unless it's its whole body? Like, is there a kind of an octopus inside the octopus, which is like a brain with all these tentacles that are then extending?
That's my understanding.
It's very interesting, because David Sharner has used the octopus as a metaphor for the false identity.
Oh, really?
As in this implant that gets installed in us physically, and then. So, and it has a nub or a head somewhere, and then it extends its tentacles into the whole nervous system, and so takes over our body and prevents consciousness from being in our body. Like, that's why we're not enlightened. Well, that's how we're not enlightened, because consciousness can't enter into our body because we've got this octopus-like implant in it.
Huh.
So it's curious that we brought up the octopus kind of in the reverse way, as the enlightened, as possibly a model for an enlightened being, because you're saying, yeah, an octopus has a brain that is in all of its body, or its whole body is neurological. That might be better put.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to say it. Yeah, because its brain is somewhat indistinct.
Right. Right. So what was the initial, why did you initially bring out the octopus?
Because you mentioned think something with your body. It wasn't thinking.
Oh, consciousness in the body.
Yeah. Consciousness in the body. And that.
And you said, oh, that's not what I mean. And I said, oh, maybe it is. That sounds.
Maybe it is. But yeah. I will. It isn't, because we don't have brains.
Oh, but we
neurologically
do.
Running through our arms.
Well, I don't know about our arms. I mean, an octopus is all arms, so if it's anywhere, it's going to be in its arms. But but we have neurons in the heart and in the intestine.
What?
You didn't know this? I mean, I don't know it, but that's what they say, the scientists, yeah. The scientistics. Yeah, you hadn't heard that?
I had heard that our hearts do some thinking, but I didn't.
There you go with thinking again. How about sentience? I much prefer sentience to thinking.
So we're sentient throughout our body.
Well, we're not. But if we're enlightened, we would be. Well, that is enlightenment, I believe.
We're blocked then.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, if the neurons in our body, like an octopus's body, if there are neurons throughout our body or the equivalent of neurons, then enlightenment is when the whole system lights up.
Wow.
And all the neurons are communicating.
So, wait a minute. Are these related to chakras or not at all?
Well, they probably are if you're into chakras, but I'm not particularly. I mean, I used to be, but okay. That's the gland. I mean, they correspond with the endocrine system and the glandular system, apparently. So, So they do have some sort of physiological correspondence.
And okay, I'm sorry. Go back to what you're saying.
That was it, really.
Oh.
Well, that was that part of it. So, yeah. So, where's consciousness if it's not in the body?
Well, that's a great question. That just makes my objection ridiculous, because we think of it as in the brain. But your brain is part of your body, but it's not necessarily in your brain.
Consciousness.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, there's two things. One, though, if you say, where's consciousness? You could say, where's it located? As in, where's the source of consciousness? And yeah, science and stuff tries to say that it's the brain. The brain is generating consciousness in some weird way. But the other way of looking at it is, where is consciousness? As in, where, what are we conscious of?
You mean the world around us, or ourselves?
Like, well, that would depend. Like, where is your consciousness right now? Like, it could be. Like, my consciousness right this second is on partly on your bow tie, because I'm looking at it. So then I'm thinking about it, and now I'm even talking about it. So some of my consciousness is going into your bow tie. I'm going to withdraw it now, because I can't afford to give that much consciousness to your bow tie. That's why you wear it, isn't it? It's like a hypnotic device.
It's not even spinning around.
Right. So yeah, we've got kids now raised with their smartphones. Their consciousness is going into the smartphones.
Wow. Yeah, they're becoming cyborgs that way. In a literal sense, right? I mean, they don't have to have the implants, because they're implanting their consciousness into something else.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a two-way thing, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like a parasite or a symbiotic entity.
Yeah. Yeah, so and its method is convenience, or one of its methods.
Mm-hmm.
It makes itself desirable to us and compatible with us by offering us things. It's like the devil, isn't it? It gives us some of these promises, and it basically makes itself seem desirable and then indispensable, like alcohol too.
And
so we let it in and we take it on and we get all of these bonuses.
And we feel superior to what we were before.
Yeah.
The parasite.
Right.
Yeah, we're all superheroes with our smartphones.
Right. But those are the myths. I mean, the superheroes are the modern myths, and the ancient myths were the gods. But the gods, you know, many of those myths were quite neurotic and petty.
Yeah, for sure.
And in other of the myths, and obviously specifically the Christian myth, the promise that we could be as gods was a curse. The knowledge, the Promethean knowledge was a curse, and knowledge of good and evil was a curse. And and that's consistent. You see, we don't have anything in the West that, I don't think, maybe I'm not thinking of it, but that corresponds with that myth in a more realistic metaphysical sense, or both realistic and or metaphysical. But in the East they do, because they say cities are a danger. Like if you develop cities, then they're like temptations of the serpent. The cities, you know, superpowers that you can develop as on the spiritual path, they whisper in your ear, you can be as gods, you know, if you just eat this. And so then you get diverted from the path to wholeness, because you want to enjoy the perks of fragmentation,
which is city life.
Not cities, but that's an interesting pun that you made.
Oh, I guess it was not unintentional. I thought you were saying city. What, you're not saying city?
Find a city, find myself a city to live in. City is like SIDDHI. So it's spiritual powers, or psychic powers rather.
I see.
That we can develop. Well, we can develop, full stop.
Interesting. All right.
Right. So, but that was interesting. You correlated it with city life.
Yeah, well, it made complete sense to me with city life.
Well, it did to me too, because I think in the city you're fragmented too, as in you know, you're just constantly distracted and you're constantly being diluted among other individuals.
Right, and hyper specialized.
Mm-hmm. And the technology is like that too. Like even we're seeing it dynamically, as in it's called parallelism. Well, that's one name for it. Multitasking is the more mundane thing. But as in we're learning to split our consciousness, so we can focus on lots of different things at the same time. That's a superpower too.
That's the one that I don't have. And you don't think they had that? Back in the Middle Ages, back in ancient Greece?
Can you imagine giving somebody in ancient Greece a smartphone and just 5 minutes to figure it out?
No, but they might have to build a fire and watch their kids at the same time.
Okay, yeah, but so I'm not saying that. I mean, even animals presumably have some capacity to be aware of. I mean, There's this thing of focused and unfocused awareness, and focused awareness, well, self-explanatory, isn't it? But if we really zero in on something, we get totally immersed in it, like you when you're painting or me when I'm writing, and we forget everything else. And it's all about the perfect brushstroke, the perfect word, and so on. And but also hunting, even gathering, you're looking for the fruit. You've got to be really focused. And yeah, you would still, yeah, if there's a threat to you, or you would still notice it. You're not shutting down. You're just narrowing the bandwidth. So 90% of your attention is on the berry or the prey, and only 10% is then distributed around the environment you're in. But that's enough that if there's a real threat to you or someone close to you, you'd still notice it.
Yeah.
And then you can shift. Unfocused awareness is when all your awareness is evenly distributed everywhere, and you're not focused on anything.
Ah, right. That's the truth of multitasking. Right, it's totally inefficient. You just feel like you're accomplishing a lot.
Okay, well, so you've gone somewhere new, because what I was describing there would be closer to enlightenment, the unfocused time. As in, okay. you're just spread out among everything. You're kind of one with everything.
Oh, interesting. So that's similar to being absorbed by the galactic consciousness, which is what you would do in life before experiencing it in death. And I said that was like enlightenment.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So I think multitasking is somewhere between the two, where you just you learn to compartmentalize your awareness and distribute it evenly without it ever becoming unfocused. But so you can focus on 10 things at the same time, and you've got 10% of your awareness on each of those things. But you're still, your awareness for each of them is being reduced.
Okay, sure. So you're saying when you, what was the name you had for it with the blurry focus?
Unfocused awareness.
Oh, unfocused. Unfocused focused is, it's not reduced. You're focused on everything and no one thing.
Yeah.
And it's not fractioned off.
Well, no, you're just not focused on anything with unfocused awareness.
Oh, you're not focused.
That's why it's unfocused.
I sort of see.
It's like a meditative state, I presume. You know, where you, well, there's no mind.
Okay.
No mind state. So you would be, like, if you imagine, how does the body perceive? Well, it's true, we do have eyes, and eyes are very directional. But if you might, you can even drop the focus of your eyes, no, and just, I'm doing it now, so I'm just not looking at anything, but I'm seeing the whole field equally. So, but the whole body is doing that anyway, like as in the body's aware of through different senses of its whole environment in an unfocused way. So we're like, if we're not listening, we just hear everything that's happening, but we don't notice it. It's only when the mind comes in and then we focus and then we notice what specific sounds.
Okay, yeah, listening is a really good example.
Yeah. So you could say the body is always, in a certain sense, the body is always in unfocused awareness, and the mind can focus the awareness of the body, but it can also kind of trap the awareness of the body so that we can't notice anything else. And so then we shut down, we get denied access to, or we deny ourselves access to unfocused awareness of the body. And we end up just trapped in this very narrow focus of the mind, which although it does have access to bodily data, it's very, very limited. So it's like we can't even see or hear anything without thinking about it. You know, like the mind's saying, look here, like me with your bow tie, saying, look here, listen to that. The mind is in control of the senses. So that means the senses are really shackled to it's a very slow operating system, the mind. Right? Like imagine if you had to try and notice everything in your environment one bite at a time with your mind, you couldn't do it.
Right.
Because it would already have changed even before, practically before you'd started, things would have already changed.
So where are we going with this?
You got me. I mean, this,
consciousness in the body, I believe is what.
Yeah, right. That was a long exploration of that concept, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I feel like we didn't even like get into it. Consciousness in the body.
Well, it was relating to the afterlife as well, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very tricky to talk about the afterlife or the eternity or any of these things with reference to the body.
Because we assume it's not going to be there with us.
Yes, and that would be true, presumably. I mean, because we don't really know what's going on, but we know that the body dies. So we come up with this version that if there's an afterlife, it would have to be something that lives in the body that then leaves the body and lives on outside the body. That's the version that we come up with, isn't it? But there's a William Blake line, which I keep coming back to recently, which is, first we must banish the idea of a body distinct from the soul, something like that. But he said something, the world will change, or the end of the world will come about in a good way via the increase of sensual enjoyment.
Ah, okay, that sounds hedonistic.
It does, but it's not. I mean, it might have been. I don't know, Blake, but it doesn't have to be anyway.
Sure.
It could also just mean the ability to enjoy a sensual experience, sensory experience. But anyway.
Right.
And it says something I just read today, which was this book called The Attention Merchants by Timothy Wu, I think. And he said that he was talking about this and how the brain filters out, you know, most of what we're surrounded by. It's, and how we're constantly just receiving all this information, just even just internally, about what's going on in our body. And the comment he makes is it's hard to believe that we could ever be bored, knowing that we receive so much information coming to us in our bodies that we have to filter out 99% of it just to be able to cope with it.
Right. Boredom is kind of a miracle when you look at it like that.
It's a negative miracle, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I'd say it's the life of the mind versus the life of the body.
Okay, so the mind gets bored.
The mind is boring.
Yeah, the mind is boring.
The mind is the most boring place in the world, isn't it? There are times, of course, where it's always telling us, come in here, this is great.
Yeah.
But essentially, well, it's both, let's put it that way. And I would say that the allure of the mind is a trick to get us to keep going back there, even though it's really boring. It's like Game of Thrones. They keep, you know, it gets worse and worse, but we keep watching it because it keeps kind of tricking us into thinking it'll get better. You're a fan of Game of Thrones. I just like that as an example because I was really into it to begin with. But
were you?
But it just got worse and worse. And I get
like worse and worse in the sense of bad filmmaking?
Yeah, writing and dialogue. And it departed from the books. And,
oh, okay.
And it just feels part of the trick was people got so dependent on it.
Oh, sure, yeah. You fall in love with the characters, you know.
Fall in love with the characters, so they just want to hang out there.
Exactly.
It deteriorates horribly. And that's like the mind. You know? The mind it's our friend, and we're just so familiar with it, and it makes all these promises, and it's going to entertain us. And it has to deliver. It's clever enough to deliver enough of the time that we keep. It's also like an alcohol, isn't it, or an addiction. Like people try to give up. One of the reasons they can't is they keep having a positive experience every now and then. Just to keep them at it. If it was all bad, they would eventually.
Yeah, you wouldn't do it.
No.
Yeah, that's the life of the mind, all right.
Because, yeah, although it does give us good ideas and stuff, most of the time it's my mind anyway, is telling me stuff that doesn't help.
Right. But, it's telling me how much I suck, how much I'm not as good as Jason Horsley, who has a thrift store. I'm not as good as this guy down the street who, you know. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
So it draws me in with some great ideas and then throws me down on the mat.
It's the bait reality. And switch. It's the bait and switch, isn't it? It whips us and says you're no good, and then it says try this, and you too can be a superhero.
But if you're lucky, you'll try it, and it'll fall apart, and something wonderful will come into the vacuum.
Right. Well, there's a term for this, which I think gets us back to our opening subject, which is the hope thing. It's called positive disintegration.
Yeah.
And it's basically that there's a process by which we see through our illusions one by one, and they fall apart and it feels terrible. But as they fall apart, those crucial fictions, those false hopes, it clears up space in our consciousness because they're filling up. It's like an internal colonization. It's like the false implant or the false identity octopus again. As that thing falls apart, those internal structures fall apart, it's creating more and more space internally.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. Something comes into that space or comes out of it, which could simply be the awareness of the body.
Maybe.
Which has two meanings as well, doesn't it? Awareness of the body.
Right? Does it?
The body's awareness and our awareness of the body.
Oh, yeah. See, I keep forgetting about that. The body has its own awareness, its own thinking. This is a new concept for me.
Well, what if thinking itself is the body's doing it? I mean, you could say, well, the brain, but I mean, what if it's like digestion?
Right. And maybe perhaps we're sharing it with all those microbes down there.
Sharing it. Well, that could be
sharing
that they...
thinking.
Yeah, or even that this given thought is our acknowledgement or our perception of that given microbe.
Whoa, yeah.
Especially if language goes into the body, which I've written about. When we learn language, I think you used a term earlier on about micro movements of the body or something like that, didn't you?
I don't think so.
When we're talking about thought, thinking, you definitely refer to something like that.
Okay, I don't remember.
When we speak or when we think, our body moves in different ways, doesn't it?
It sure does, yeah. Well, when we speak, I know. I mean,
when we speak, it certainly does. And as they say, that when primitive people communicate and more aware of it, as primitive as in more aware of it, what they're responding to, that their response comes before the words, like the way that the mouth is shaped and the throat and the larynx and the vocal, you know, all those vibrations and those micro movements that are pushing the words out, that's what communicates. The words are just kind of a ripple or an after spray or something.
Wow. Yeah.
So I think, and this is a new theory I come up with recently, that most of our thinking is the body trying to get rid of something, like detoxify, because those thoughts were put in us, like language, like trauma-based mind control. We had negative self-hating thoughts put in us, and the body's trying to get rid of them. But as it's trying to get rid of them, they're coming like toxins. We feel them, right? So in this case, we think them. We keep thinking them because the body's pushing them out. But because we don't let go of them, they don't go out. They just keep staying, you know?
That's interesting. It makes me think of speaking in tongues. It talks about, you know, the Bible talks about speaking in tongues and how, does it say the body is edified? I wonder if it does. It's edifying to speak in tongues, which is just, you know, glossalia. As far as we know, it's just nonsense. Unless it actually is the language of angels, we don't know. But I mean, that would possibly aid this process.
Well, I guess it would be a spectrum, wouldn't it? It's like, as you're detoxifying, first of all, the toxins are coming out. But then if you persist long enough, then eventually what's coming out gets cleaner and clearer and cleaner till eventually you're just, you know, you're breathing and exuding just the natural fragrances of the body or the natural substances of the body. So it could be the same with language. You've got to start with that deep, dark, sticky id stuff.
Mm.
You know? And then eventually you'll be singing with the angels.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a way we can do it more deliberately.
The glossolalia?
Right. If that would be a key. Assuming that deliberately working on this would increase the velocity of the healing.
Right, that is an assumption, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's back to trying to make the world a better place or help people, and rather than just following what feels good. Now, this is where I'm at, is like I don't want to impose upon myself routines and regimes that I think will make me a better human being or make me happier or anything like that. But nor do I want to just keep indulging in all ways that I know didn't work.
Okay, good.
So I'm sort of waiting for, over the years, I mean, not today, but always waiting for the body, my experience of and in the body to get over time, to get more in tune so that I'm more and more unable to enjoy things that are unproductive and the opposite. You know, my enjoyment is more and more wholesome.
Because it's productive?
Oh, it's more and more productive because it's wholesome.
Oh, okay. Yeah. In the traditional sense, wholesome?
What's that?
No drinking, no drugs, saying your prayers, having a family.
Okay, so that's, what is that, four things. I don't say prayers and I don't have a family. The first two, I could tick those boxes. I mean, I don't think, you know, wholesome is just it's an old-fashioned word, maybe, but I'm not sure if there was a tradition of being wholesome per se. And I mean, it's just generally kind of square, isn't it, to talk about being wholesome at all now?
Yeah, and it probably is. And to describe anything as being square is probably also square.
Uh-huh.
Wholesome. It's possible that the word wholesome came into vogue as a reaction against the loss of wholesomeness. You know, like if you're in it, if everybody's in it, you wouldn't even see it.
Sure. That's a very long curve we're talking about. But we can see a much shorter, steeper curve in the last 50 years or something.
Yeah. Well, definitely.
Where, yeah, more and more unwholesome ways of life have become the norm, including the technology, I guess. Although it might be too early to determine. So anyway, it has to be, this is my point, it has to be an individual's relationship with his or her body that determines what's wholesome. But that itself is wholesome. Like to have a relationship with one's body requires wholesomeness, but it also leads to wholesomeness.
Right. Okay, so you're practicing being whole by having a relationship with your body.
Right.
Okay, I see. I get it.
Right. Rather than using the mind or experiencing the mind or relating to the mind as if it were independent of the body.
Right.
Because how many things are there that we do that satisfy our mind? There's a song, isn't there? Unsatisfied mind or satisfied mind. How many of those things we do because we try and satisfy our mind, well, A, don't satisfy our mind for very long, and B, aren't good for our bodies. or at least aren't what our bodies would choose if they didn't have a mind that was perennially unsatisfied.
Right, right. Sitting for hours in front of a screen. Would never exist.
It would never exist, did you say? You froze out there, so I might have lost.
Yeah, I did. If there was no separation between mind and body, we wouldn't do things that harm the body and make the mind drunk, like sitting in front of a screen all day long or all night long, depending on which screen we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you get connected to your body then? Working out, walking in the woods, mindfulness.
How do I? You're talking like personally as what do I do?
Well, mostly hypothetically, but if you have a personal example.
Well, I do try and walk every day, and I walk in the forest because I live just on the edge of the forest. Spend time in the sun when it's sunny. There aren't that many things I do, and that doesn't mean that I'm always doing other stuff. I just mean that there aren't many things I do specifically, like I do yoga twice a week as well, because I think they come under the banner of using the will or using the mind to try and get in touch with the body and doing what the mind thinks, yeah, would be good for the body.
Yeah.
As opposed to letting the body lead. If you think about sex, I mean, it's got to be the best example, isn't it?
Sure, yeah, yeah. That's definitely the body leading.
Well, it isn't for most people anymore. I don't think people are choosing porn over real sex these days. I mean, new generations, more and more. But even before that, you've got sex aids, you've got Viagra, you've got fantasy role-playing, you've got any number of ways in which people have sex because mentally they decide they want to and it's time. And, you know, even just, you know, stimulating each other to get in the mood, whatever. It's like, well, I don't want to use personal examples because obviously it's a bit private, but I think it's probably another example, and we keep coming back to this, of letting go of the false hope, which means being willing to be in a place of despair, which could be impotence or powerlessness or, you know, no sex in this example, to see if something will actually come into that place and be a genuine hope, desire, impetus, you know, movement towards enjoyment, as opposed to, you know, the mind's contrivance of something, because it can't stand to just be in the no hope zone. But everybody must have an experience. Well, I don't know everybody, because now they're using porn, they can avoid that. But everybody who's been in an intimate long-term relationship, let's say, which is probably less and less people as well, I don't know, sexually speaking, must have that experience of like wanting it to be real, but wanting something so badly that they can't necessarily hold out for the real, as in, you know, so they'll fake it a little bit, or they'll say I love you when they don't quite mean it, or they'll pretend that they're more excited or aroused than they are, or they'll keep going even though they're suddenly not in it anymore because it'll come back in a second. All the things that we would do just to maintain the desired sexual romantic encounter or experience, but that we're kind of aware, oh, I'm not really in the flow now, even when we talk. Right? How many times, even in this conversation, have we lost the thread a little bit, but not wanted the discomfort of it all just going splat?
Yeah, quite a few times, yeah, yeah. Trying to tie things back together and trying to maintain it, yeah.
Yeah.
And it, okay, so Okay, so sex is the best example of the following the body, which hopefully we would do. But conversation, is that an example of following the body? It seems like that's two thinkers thinking together, getting their thoughts together.
It might seem like that, but I'd say that would be a more lifeless conversation than it needed to be. Like if it were just two minds swapping information or ideas, it would be definitely be less meaty than, you know, like when we watch drama, movies and TV, we don't want to just see two people discussing ideas, do we? We want to see some real physical, emotional engagement.
Yeah, that's true.
So you could say that there's a spectrum of conversations there as well, like how much two people are really getting into the
flow. Do you think that we're limited because, you know, we're disconnected by thousands of miles?
I think it's an obstacle, yeah, because I think it makes it easier to go in the mind or stay in the mind and associate it with, I mean, it's mediated, so I think it goes both ways though, because we also feel less vulnerable and safer, so that might make us more relaxed, and we might be more open because of that.
That's possible.
And we've created a context.
The context?
We've created a space for it, which, okay, in theory, you could do that in the same place as well, but I don't know if theory is relevant when practice is different from it, because the theory, the reality is that I can't have these kind of conversations in the real world because I live in a town with only 3,000 people and I don't want to talk to most of them. I have to find people where I can find them, and they're usually thousands of miles away.
Yeah, well, that's a great strength of the technology.
Yeah. That's the strength, I think. Mm-hmm. Discovering connections that I would say already existed, but certainly that will exist independently of the technology.
Was that last part? That pre-existed?
I would say, but then I can be a mystic. I'm known to go mystical. Oh. But yeah, that pre-exist the technological. Like you and I found each other through technology. We've never met outside of technology, but... I would say they're both mystic, really. I would say that we now have a connection that is independent of the technology. Mm. And even that we probably therefore had one before we used the technology to encounter each other.
Yeah, you think so? Yeah. So you think that pre-existing connection is what draws us together?
Right. Potentially.
That's potentially very interesting. Yeah. I mean, I'm saying potentially jokingly because you just said potentially, but I'm fascinated by that because I have no idea what drew me to you, except that I liked that you said things that nobody else says, and why I would reach out, I have no idea, you know?
Well, you reached out because you wanted to make contact.
Yeah, I guess that's the obvious reason. Sure,
it's a bit tautological, really, but
yeah, but I don't reach out to everybody. That's the thing. I don't, like, I've never written a letter to Murakami, for instance.
To what?
Haruki Murakami, the author.
Okay, right. Well, I signal accessibility, I think, to some people anyway. I make it clear that I'm accessible.
Oh yeah, maybe you do. It might even say on your webpage somewhere.
It does say on the webpage. It says, "I'm really, really lonely. Please contact me."
That's a great way to make friends.
So, yeah, I mean, it is potentially mystical, but I think it's necessary. It's like the afterlife is mystical, but it's also necessary because I think that we're aware of other layers to our experience that aren't represented by Well, they aren't represented without something that seems mystical. That's the whole point, isn't it? Because they're not represented by the conventional model that we have for understanding stuff. They seem mystical.
Right, right. Yeah, and so just because we don't have any way of explaining it, we're in that uncomfortable area of mysticism or metaphysical.
Metaphysical, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but I would say that it's necessary not as a hope thing, you know, as a way to give purpose so much, as a way to explain something. Like, why does it feel so meaningful to me to talk to you or other people that I connect with, even though I know that at a certain level, it's all futile.
yeah, it is at a certain level.
At a certain level. I mean, so it's a bit vague because you could extend that to everything. But then I suppose I would. There's a metaphysical dimension.
We can give it some solidity by saying it's futile because there's no physical connection. I mean, we're not in the same room.
Right, but I don't think it's that. I mean, yeah, I suppose we're contriving it as opposed to it being organic. Like if I have a conversation with someone in a thrift store, they've just come into, you know, we have encountered each other. So we're just, you know, working with what life has given us. Whereas here we're actually contriving something and making it happen. So we definitely assume that there's some meaning and purpose to it, right? And so then the superficially, that's the podcast. We're doing this to make a podcast. And mm-hmm. If we weren't doing it to make a podcast, we might not have the same kind of conversation. Even last time it didn't get recorded, but we thought it was recording. If we'd known it wasn't recording, our energy would have been different. And quite likely we wouldn't have enjoyed it as much.
You think so?
Well, it's possible. It could go either way, but let's say it would certainly, it certainly influences it.
Yeah, well, it does, yeah.
And what I'm saying is that having a sense of purpose is good. It feels good to do something that feels meaningful, as opposed to just, oh, well, you like my work. I want to hear, you know, let's just get to know each other online. That feels a bit amorphous and a bit, you know?
Right.
Right?
Yeah. And that kind of thing usually just becomes an exchange of pleasantries that peters off.
Right, because it's social.
Mm-hmm.
So this is my point, is that it seems to me that there's a purpose for interacting with human beings which is not social.
Go on. Oh, you're saying that's it?
Therefore,
okay.
That's a space that metaphysics fill. Like it's easy to fill it with a metaphysical explanation. Possibly too easy, but tempting anyway.
Yeah.
And I don't go too far. I'll just say, I believe there's an invisible community of souls that we are part of, and that we're already connected. That's what that means. So uncovering those connections is meaningful to us, because then we're bringing something from the invisible into the visible, and from the unconscious into consciousness, and that's what we're here for.
Right.
Like in an ontological sense, or in the universal sense, we're here to become conscious of what we are, which would also be what we were before we arrived here and what we will be after we leave. That would be what we are, because we forget what we are when we get embedded in the physical. Now I am getting metaphysical.
Okay, yeah. Isn't that seem like a problem? So you're saying by paying attention to the physical, to our bodies, we can remember.
Right. Yeah, I think so. And I think that's because the body is a transmitter of and a receiver of what we are before we have a body.
Mm.
That's why we have a body. It's, I don't know, is that circular?
No, I don't necessarily think so. I mean, it would make sense. So whatever collection of atoms the body is tuned to a certain frequency that draws in our non-body.
No, I think I did go too far with that, because I think, see, I got into a, I think I heard you signed up for Dave's thing on Sunday, is that right?
I did, yeah.
I think you're going to influence me, actually, because I was undecided about whether to sign up or not, and now I think I will, so there's a tip for tap.
Interesting.
Because I'll be curious to be there if you're going to be there. But the reason I mentioned that was because there was a period where I was involved with Dave where it went a bit funny and I dropped out for a couple of years. And before the dropout, I ended up expressing a bit of consternation at my blog, nothing major, quite minor. But one of the things I said was enlightenment transmission wrong.
Oh, wow.
Embodiment cheesecloth, right. And I'd have to go back and read the thing, but I said it's not a transmission, because the transmission suggests something that's coming from somewhere else to somewhere else, and that therefore is kind of linear and so on. And it's not like that. It's not like a line of saying it's something that's everywhere. So then I had cheesecloth, and it's not enlightenment, it's embodiment. And so my idea was, is that my sense was, what I was trying to articulate was that the transmission doesn't, it's not like the transmission comes through the body, it's that the body comes out of the transmission, which is like a cheesecloth.
Okay.
You know, like a cheesecloth, you have this structure, this grid that is embedded in something, and then the substance grows around it, out of it.
What's the substance that grows around cheesecloth? Cheese?
Cheese, yeah.
Does it really?
Yeah, it's how you make cheese.
So I see.
You put the cloth in the mixture, the yogurt, whatever, the formless.
Yeah.
You put a structure in the formless, and then forms grow out of it.
Aha.
So I think that's different. And I'm being a stickler on this, because I'm reading this book, American Cosmic, or I've just read it and I'm writing about it. And one of the things I see in there is it talks a lot about the body as a receiver transmitter, and information is physical and all this stuff.
Yeah, information is physical. Interesting.
Yeah. And so it's kind of superficially in line with some of the stuff I believe, but it also seems to be part of this scientistic project to create a counterfeit for an experience of the divine via the technology and the UFO and occultism,
really?
And all these things that I've been exploring. And so I think, yeah, there's something kind of wrong there. There's something a bit off there. They want to reduce the whole of existence, even God, to an information-based universe, because that's what they understand, because they're computer scientists and all the rest of it.
Right, yeah. Right? But is it that it's just a metaphor, or do you think the metaphor is, I mean, is it a detrimental metaphor? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm concerned about. That's why I got stuck on that, because, so I used to say for myself, the transmission is my soul. The soul creates the transmission, but really the transmission is my soul, and it's transmitting through my body. Hence, I've got to be connected with my body to connect to my soul, because that's how I follow the transmission through the body to the soul. But then the Blake thing, that the body and the soul are really one thing that we've split into two with our minds, then the body is the transmission too.
Mm. Yeah.
The transmission is the body. So it's not simply that. So yes, it's more mysterious than that. I don't know if it's, I don't want to be splitting hairs and getting us more confused than we probably already are, but there was the context for this. It was the invisible community, wasn't it? Oh yeah, and about why we're here.
What?
Why we're here.
Oh, you and I here, or all of us as humanity.
Yeah, both.
Right, to find the people that we're invisibly connected to. And
yeah,
awaken our body, our bodily connection to the soul, to light it up.
And if, like, the neurons in the body we talked about already, so this can only happen, I think, through finding the other neurons. Like, we can only light up our signal transmission by connecting to other neurons, and vice versa. We can only connect to them by lighting up. So it's a bit of a conundrum, but it's that both are happening simultaneously. Like, the more we tune into our own sense of existing, which is purpose and meaning and all of that comes with it, and enjoyment, the more we are drawn into encounters with others, and then that amplifies the signal. So something's happening now that's potentially observable, and that seems to have a purpose, like a direction to it.
If it's observable, it should be experimentable, right?
Experiential or experimental, experimentable.
Experimentable, so that we could discover more about it, you know?
Test it. Well, that's,
yeah. See if we can see what it's about.
Yeah.
You could Which do that. Yeah. Might be the purpose of the technology. That
was a technological stutter.
We built this system, and now we're using it to connect, which is somewhat of a problem because it's often an addictive connection, right? When you think of this cellular device, but yet.
It's what we're connecting to is the question.
Ah, right. Okay, so are we connecting to the transference, the vehicle, the bus, or are we connecting to the people on the other side? Right.
Yeah. Are we connecting to the medium or the message? Are we connecting to the technology or the consciousness that's on the other end of the technology?
Yeah.
Because it might be either or. Like, the less sentient our connections are through the technology, the more we're just in it for to deepen our relationship with the technology.
Hang on a second. Well, Mr. Horsley, I think we are...
What, out of time?
We're out of time, yeah. There's a meeting coming into this room, and this is where I have my internet connection.
Okay. Well, gosh, we actually been on 2 hours.
Yeah, you might have to edit that down. Like, edit out all of my parts.
Well, that's incredible. I thought we'd only been on an hour or something.
Oh, that's good. That's good to hear.
That is good. That doesn't usually happen. I usually have a good sense of time. So something must have happened that was mysterious there.
Oh, all right. I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope we can increase the connections across the globe. At least amongst your 30 viewers.
Right. All 30 of them.
Yeah.
In one room together. That would be the goal.
Exactly.
Probably in Finland somewhere.
I hear a voice that's not my own. It tells me to jump into the sea. I'm tired of listening to these words. I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me. I won't listen anymore.
friends somewhat prematurely, right on time. My conversation with the Scrouse. You can find out more about the Scrouse in the show notes, maybe. Might lead you somewhere. If you enjoyed this conversation, let me know. Scrouse seems like somebody I might want to do regular podcasts with, so let me know if you agree with that estimation. That's it for this week. I won't do the usual spiel. Just help out if you can. You know the ways. Let me count them for you. This is Jason Horsley signing out and off to Finland. For the Limitless, the podcast between, for the experience between the betweens of the in-between, I will still be here in spirit and in cybernetic footprint.
Family of one speaks clone.